The infant American Republic took its first shaky steps amid World War. In fact, a struggle that lasted more than two decades as Britain and France battled for global empire. Although the United States was 3,000 miles away from the epicenter of conflict, the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars aroused volcanic passions that nearly blew the new nation apart. War and terror aren't just part of the recent American experience. On the contrary, they were present at the creation. In Paris, the Bastille fell on July the 14th, 1789, a few months after George Washington had been sworn in as the first president of the United States. Before the end of Washington's first four-year term, the French king had gone to the guillotine, and revolutionaries in Paris were waging total war on the rest of France and most of Europe, giving us our modern terms terror and terrorist. By the time Washington died in 1799, the French Revolution was officially over, but instead France had a megalomaniac dictator, Napoleon, who wasn't finally toppled until 1815. How should the new American nation respond to this world crisis? President Washington offered a simple answer: keep out of the war and stay united. He stuck to a policy of American neutrality throughout his presidency, and in his farewell address, he advised his compatriots,
"The great rule of conduct for us in regard to foreign nations is, in extending our commercial relations, to have with them as little political connection as possible. Europe has a set of primary interests, which to us have none or a very remote relation. Hence, she must be engaged in frequent controversies, the causes of which are essentially foreign to our concerns. Our detached and distant situation invites and enables us to pursue a different course."
In particular, Washington warned his fellow countrymen against forming political parties polarized between Britain and France.
"A passionate attachment of one nation for another gives to ambitious, corrupted, or deluded citizens who devote themselves to the favorite nation facility to betray or sacrifice the interests of their own country without odium, sometimes even with popularity."
But this partisanship was exactly what happened. By the mid-1790s, much of the country was divided between supporters of Thomas Jefferson and backers of Alexander Hamilton, who'd been two leading members of Washington's cabinet. The two sides had diametrically opposed views of the French Revolution and its implications for America. Jefferson's supporters, known as the Democratic Republicans, were strongest in the South, while the main base of Hamilton and his Federalist Party lay in the North. Jefferson loved France. He believed that the French Revolution, despite some unfortunate excesses, was basically carrying on the fight for freedom that Americans had begun a decade earlier. In 1793, he spoke in extravagant terms about what was at stake in France.
"The liberty of the whole earth was depending on the issue of the contest. My own affections have been deeply wounded by some of the martyrs to this cause, but rather than it should have failed, I would have seen half the earth desolated."
Even after the Paris Terror broke in full frenzy, Jefferson turned a blind, or at least an indulgent, eye. He was much more worried that Hamilton and his Federalist supporters would exaggerate the crisis in France to justify a pro-British foreign policy and the repression of liberty at home. And he feared that President Washington and Vice President John Adams were becoming Hamilton's tools. He told an Italian friend,
"In place of that noble love of liberty and republican government which carried us triumphantly through the war, an Anglican, monarchical, and aristocratical party has sprung up, whose avowed object is to draw over us the substance, as they have already done the forms, of the British government. It would give you a fever were I to name to you the apostates who have gone over to these heresies, men who were Samsons in the field and Solomons in the council, but who have had their heads shorn by the harlot England."
When this letter was leaked to the press, the references to Samson and Solomon were widely taken as an attack on Washington and Adams. Washington retired from the presidency after 2 4-year terms, setting a firm precedent for his successors. And the political battle intensified when Adams won the presidential election of 1796. Hoping for unity, he retained most of Washington's cabinet, but this was unwise, for they proved passionate Federalists tied to Hamilton, and he was regarded as their tool. Relations with Jefferson, an old friend and officially Adams's vice president, degenerated into suspicious silence. By 1798, the US and France teetered on the edge of war. French warships were seizing American merchant vessels, and when Adams tried to negotiate a diplomatic solution, French agents brazenly demanded some financial backhanders before talks could even commence. Adams refused to negotiate under such humiliating circumstances, and when he published details of the French demands, there was an outcry across the country. The slogan was, "Millions for defence, but not a cent for tribute," and men flocked enthusiastically to the colours. The Marseillaise, previously all the rage, was dropped in favour of American patriotic songs such as "Hail Columbia."
Firm, united let us be, rallying round our liberty. As a band of brothers joined, peace and safety we shall find.
Hamilton and the Federalists, as paranoid about the French revolutionary threat to America as the Jeffersonians were obsessed about Anglophile monocrats, now saw their chance. As part of this War on Terror, 1790s style, they pushed through Congress draconian laws known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. The president was given authority to deport aliens that he considered dangerous to the peace and safety of the United States. The Sedition Act was even harsher, threatening to stifle virtually all political criticism.
If any person shall write, print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, and malicious writing or writings against the government of the United States, or either House of the Congress of the United States, or the President of the United States, with intent to bring them into contempt or disrepute, or to stir up sedition within the United States, then such person, being thereof convicted, shall be punished by a fine not exceeding $2,000 and by imprisonment not exceeding 2 years.
Reacting to the Alien and Sedition Acts, at the end of 1798, the states of Kentucky and Virginia passed special resolutions. They asserted that the individual states had created the federal government, giving it only limited powers, which it was now grossly abusing. The implication was that the states could overrule unpopular actions of the federal government. Here was a classic statement of states' rights, a doctrine that would bedevil the Union for the next 60 years and eventually break it apart in civil war. In fact, civil war seemed very close during the election campaign of 1800. A replay of Adams versus Jefferson in 1796, but this time for much higher stakes and with no holes barred. Adams was pilloried by Jefferson's supporters as a closet monarchist who wanted to impose a British-style centralised government. They mocked his vanity and love of titles, whereas Washington had been addressed with natural respect as His Excellency. Adams was lampooned as His Rotundity. On the other side, Federalists warned that Jefferson wanted a French-style revolution to subvert the Constitution and undermine Christianity. Choosing the President of the United States in 1800 was a far cry from electioneering today. The selection was made by the Electoral College, a group of wise men chosen by the states. Six states chose their presidential electors by the people's vote, but the other 10 left the choice to the state legislature. And because each state could select the day on which to choose its electors, the business spread out from April all the way to October, further heightening the tension. Yet for all the differences in procedure, the result in 1800 was as messy as the election of the year 2000, George Bush versus Al Gore, which was ultimately decided by the US Supreme Court. Although Jefferson beat Adams, he amassed the same number of supporters in the Electoral College as Aaron Burr from New York. Officially, Burr was Jefferson's vice presidential running mate, but in 1800 that wasn't specified on the voting papers. In the event of a tie between two candidates, the issue had to be decided in the US House of Representatives, and Federalists saw this as their last chance to stop Jefferson and probable anarchy by throwing their support behind Burr. Jefferson regarded this Federalist ploy as a dirty trick to frustrate the verdict of the electors, and went to complain in person at the White House. But Adams insinuated that he was ready to undermine the country's stability, telling Jefferson,
"Sir, the event of the election is within your own power. You have only to say you will do justice to the public creditors, maintain the Navy, and not disturb those holding office, and the government will be instantly put into your hands. We know it is the wish of the people it should be so."
"Mr. Adams, I know not what part of my conduct in either public or private life can have authorized a doubt of my fidelity to the public engagements. I say, however, I will not come into the government by capitulation. I will not enter on it, but in perfect freedom to follow the dictates of my own judgment."
"Then things must take their course."
So battle was joined in the House of Representatives between supporters of Jefferson and Burr. No less than 35 votes were taken, but each time Jefferson fell one short of the majority he needed. In the end, the deadlock was broken by James Bayard, a Federalist from Delaware, who finally switched sides, saying,
"We must risk the Constitution and civil war, or take Mr. Jefferson."
And so Thomas Jefferson squeaked into the White House. But Adams left office with a great achievement, a peace treaty with France. Though it came too late to win him re-election, it saved America from being dragged into the World War. And contrary to all the paranoia about civil war, Jefferson's inaugural address struck a note of reconciliation. He'd always believed that extreme Hamiltonians were a tiny, perverted minority in an essentially united nation. Now he reached out across the political divide. Few in the Senate chamber on March 4, 1801, could hear exactly what Jefferson said, but his words were read across the nation.
"We have called, by different names, brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. Let us then, with courage and confidence, pursue our federal and Republican principles, our attachment to union and representative government."
The bipartisan tone of Jefferson's inaugural address was conciliatory and effective. Despite the passions unleashed by the French Revolution, America had remained neutral in the World War. Despite all the tensions between North and South, the Union had held together. The United States had survived its first War on Terror.